Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Conflict and weather are presenting several challenges to internally displaced people in South Sudan, including malnutrition. UN agencies warn that food supplies for thousands of African refugees at a camp in central Malawi are running out fast. The organization is appealing for urgent funds to provide full rations for the coming year. On the show today, we will discuss the situation of refugees and internally displaced people in sub-Saharan Africa and what is the case of healthcare in conflict zones. Well, to do that today, we are joined in the studio for more with by Mark Yarnell. He's senior advocate with Refugees International. Mr. Yarnell, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have you here. Let me tell our listeners, if you'd like to join us, you can email your questions or comments on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat. We did take some of your questions and concerns, and we will try to share them with our guests today. And for the phone call, it is 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1 if you'd like to call us. We will start our discussion shortly, but first, VOA's Nick Long takes a look at the return of internally displaced people in the DRC.
The great majority of the estimated 700,000 displaced people in North Kivu are not living in camps and not receiving food aid. Nevertheless, donors are getting tired of paying for the more than 50 camps in the province, says Ben Adua, a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration in North Kivu. The donors have been funding the same things for a long time and funds are getting short, he told reporters. Part of the reason for donor fatigue is the realization that the number of people in the camps was exaggerated. Last year, after nighttime checks were carried out at 31 sites in North Kivu, the numbers at those sites were found to be two-thirds lower than initial estimates, according to a joint report by the organisations managing the camps in North Kivu. Some of that reduction would have been due to improved security, enabling people to return home, but the report clearly suggests that another reason was inflated figures. This year, five camps near Goma have been closed, and the people there have mostly returned to their home villages or resettled in areas near Goma. VOA spoke to a formerly displaced person, Jean-Pierre Havugimana, who left the Lac Vert camp near Goma last month and returned to his village, Kimoka. He told VOA he's very happy to be back home because people did not eat well at the camp and washing was difficult, whereas life is much better in his village. He adds that he wants to thank the organisations who help the returnees, but they also need tools like machetes and hoes, as well as seeds for farming. His neighbour, Faraka Songo, is vice president of the group of people from the Lac Vert camp who have moved to Kimoka. She tells VOA she and her family were promised seeds that have not yet arrived, and that makes life difficult for them because they depend on agriculture for their food. The seed distribution is the responsibility of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and was supposed to have happened by the middle of last month. Ben Adua of the International Organization for Migration told VOA it's been delayed. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
And Mark Yarnell, you heard this report. Now, you've worked in the DRC in the past. What is your reaction to what you heard, given your experience on the ground?
I guess my reaction to what I've been hearing in comparison to what I experienced is just how, tragically, that the same issues are continuing. I was last in Congo in 2011, looking at food security issues. Prior to that, I worked with a healthcare organization in 2005 and 2006, and you could have heard this exact report back each of those two times as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's continuation of conflict in very particular areas that is having a dramatic effect on the well-being of populations. And I think just one important point to emphasize is that you know, while there's a lot of attention on acute conflict and on people dying as a result of attacks on various towns or particular skirmishes that go on, it's people who, because of the conflict, can't access basic health care, whether it's for malaria or for diarrhea or pneumonia. And those are the people who, the vast majority of people die as a result of those kinds of secondary issues. Mm-hmm. And it's just tragic that this many years on, it's continuing.
So then when we look at it, it seems like there's no progress. There seems to be no progress, at least talking about the DRC, and correct me if I'm wrong. So will the solution then be the end of the conflict, really? Or is it the need to improve the healthcare system? What is it?
Well, it's both of those. There's no question that because it's the conflict that is the cause of these problems, that until the conflict ends, you won't reach ultimate solution. But there needs to be planning in advance, both to, you know, to be able to help people more in the medium term, but in the long term, there's been destruction of so many aspects of the healthcare infrastructure that if we don't begin now to rehabilitate health centers and have trained staff and have appropriate equipment and medicine, then even when the war ends and people are able to return home to their villages, they'll still be impacted by those basic primary healthcare issues that are killing millions of people, literally. Mm-hmm. The International Rescue Committee in mortality studies they've done, I think, you know, between 1998 and 2007, even though it's continuing, estimated that 5.4 million people died as a result of aspects of the conflict.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's sort of, you know, keeping attention on the need to have a political resolution of the conflict and the responsibility of the Congolese government to be providing for its own people. But in the meantime, I think that for external actors, while there's benefit in having, mobile health clinics that go in short term for an area or an emergency group that sets up a temporary hospital somewhere, if we don't provide support to the local health centers and the local health systems and the people who will be there after the war finishes, mm-hmm. then the problems won't be solved.
Yeah. So let's look at the big picture, and then we will narrow down to specifics. When we look at sub-Saharan Africa in general, in terms of data, if you have any, what would you say as far as the number of IDPs, internally displaced people, or refugees? I mean, whether it's a specific number or just to give us a sense of what the picture is like.
Yeah, tragically, the sub-Saharan Africa is impacted most by displacement compared to any other region around the world. There's estimated to be about 3 million refugees, so those people who have fled and crossed the border to try to escape conflict and seek refuge. Mm-hmm. But that number is dwarfed by the number of people who are displaced internally. So there's upwards of another 10 to 13 million people who have fled their home within their country but haven't crossed into a border. And they're often the people that are most difficult to reach because once someone's crossed the border into safety, they can be accessed by international organizations, by UN Refugee Agency. Mm-hmm. When there's conflict continuing internally and someone has fled, but they're still in an area of conflict, it's very hard for aid actors to reach them and provide basic services. So they're a group that we should be very concerned about.
So when we talk, when we give these data and numbers and everything, the fact that you just mentioned that sometimes it's hard to even reach the IDPs, in terms of the reality of the number of people that are displaced, do we really think to know exactly how many people are displaced?
No,
this is just an estimate, right?
No, it's a good question, and it's a challenge for the UN, for example, when they're trying to make their planning figures over the course of a year.
Yes.
And, you know, we don't even know necessarily what the actual population of a country is sometimes because a census hasn't been done for 10 to 15 years, let alone how many people are actually displaced. So a lot of it is, it's estimated. There's a effort to triangulate information and understand what's happening. But it's, we have to realize that those numbers are, they could be worse, they could be a bit better. But when you're still getting into the, you know, 8, 9, 10, up to potentially 15 million, it's a magnitude that is, I think, should be striking to anyone.
Mm. Now, tell us about what will be the difference in terms of the way refugees are handled, or at least some of what they have access to when they are within sub-Saharan Africa, as opposed to traveling abroad. We've seen in the news so many refugees are crossing the ocean to go abroad in Europe and everything. So is there a difference between those that are moving within sub-Saharan Africa and those that are moving to Europe or other countries?
Yeah, well, I can give you an example with Somalia, for example, where I have encountered and engaged and discussed these issues with Somalis in the Dadaab camp in Kenya, mm-hmm. refugees who have fled to Kenya. And then just later, at the end of 2015, I was in Greece, and I met a large number of Somalis who had arrived in Greece, so they'd made the journey. For the full scope of population, the fact that they've had to leave their country because of the conflict and the conflict's continuing, and they aren't able to go home, is pretty horrific. I think that for some people who cross into Dadaab and are living there, that many of them were agriculturalists, pastoralists, sort of dependent on the land for their survival. And when they crossed, had to flee into Dadaab for services, now are sort of reliant on the food that's being delivered and on healthcare that's being accessed in the camps. For other people who are a bit more well off and have more access to resources, mm-hmm. because it's very expensive to try to continue the journey. I think many people want to continue the journey, you know, away from Dadaab and try to get to Europe.
Yeah.
But it costs thousands of dollars to essentially pay smugglers to move up north through northern Africa and then somehow get yourself to Turkey, by example. And then once you're in Turkey, pay another group of smugglers. And so when we met a group of Somalis who were basically had arrived in Greece and were now trying to move through Macedonia and into towards Germany, what they told us is that they had basically sold everything they had and given up everything they could, everything that they owned, to be able to pay for the journey to get there. Mm-hmm. But at least they had that initial resources.
Yes.
But now they're basically waiting for relatives to send some more money so they could continue the journey on.
Oh, wow.
But it's sort of the I think that because they had the resources, they could at least begin the journey, whereas many people we meet in camps in Kenya, it's not an option for them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned Dadaab. It's one of the largest, if not the largest, refugee camp in sub-Saharan Africa. What can you tell us about what is happening there? Some people have been there for a long time. That, you know, at what point do they think about returning, or what kind of program is put in place for the refugees to go back, even when there is some idea of end of conflict? It seems like some refugees still remain in refugee camp.
Yeah, and for some, it's the only life they've known. I mean, not only do you have thousands of people who were born themselves in Dadaab, but now they have children who were born in Dadaab, so you have third generation refugees, basically. And so they don't even there is no home necessarily to return to if the only home they've known is in the camp. Certainly, as conditions hopefully improve in certain parts of Somalia, some people can begin to go home, and we've seen that in small numbers. There's been about 4,000 or 5,000 people who've returned to Kismayo, for example, over the past year. But we have to be realistic that it returning to Somalia will not be a viable option in the near term for the vast majority of refugees. And so there's two things.
Mm-hmm.
Give people other options. The many Somalis live in urban areas, and so they can integrate into Kenyan life and have a bit more of an existence that's a bit more normal rather than living in a camp. And so while they're in refuge, they're still trying to work and get educated and live a life they're more used to. And then secondly, what is, I think, unconscionable is that Kenya continues to treat the camp as a temporary site. So are no real roads. There's no plumbing system. All the school buildings, health buildings, they're all temporary structures that can be, you know, blown over by the wind. Even though the camp's been there for over 2 decades, the Kenyan government wants to maintain its character as a temporary site,
okay,
without acknowledging the fact that it's a city, and the fact you have people who've been there and grown up there not being able to, you know, access basic plumbing is not out of lack of resources, but of lack of government policy, I think, is a really tragic outcome of the current situation in Dadaab.
I guess some people hope also that this will be a temporary situation, even though it's been there for two decades, as you mentioned. So now let's talk about South Sudan. There are reports about malnutrition and other issues. What can you tell us? What is happening in South Sudan?
Right, and South Sudan, prior to the beginning of the current conflict, already had quite a challenged health system in terms of and lack of resources and pretty high mortality rates and that sort of thing, but things are moving in a positive direction. Unfortunately, with the onset of this conflict, it's had an absolutely devastating effect on the basic health infrastructure. There's, 1,400 individual health centers throughout the country, so they're sort of spread out and theoretically could be accessible to people. But those centers don't have appropriate medicine. They don't have many of the people who were doctors or nurses. They themselves had to flee. What we've had is people dying at dramatic rates from, again, basic things like diarrhea, like malaria, children who can't get vaccinated, many women dying as a result of childbirth because they can't access healthcare workers who can be with them during that period. And then in addition to that, beyond people who are dying because of lack of access to healthcare, this conflict has taken on a character whereby armed groups are going into health centers, into hospitals, and literally killing patients while they're in their bed. So somewhere, in other conflicts where, a hospital or a health center was deemed kind of a neutral safe zone, that's been completely blown out of the water here. And even if you're in a hospital bed being treated, it doesn't mean you're in a safe space.
Wow. Okay. We are going to take a short break and we had a couple of questions on Facebook that we will share with you. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Mark Yarnell, who is the senior advocate with Refugees International. Don't go away. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Health Chat. And today we are discussing refugees, internally displaced people, and the situation around healthcare and other challenges. Our guest is Mark Yarnell. He's senior advocate with Refugees International. And Mark, as I mentioned earlier, we had a couple of questions on Facebook. And this question is from Peter in Nigeria. He wants to know, in general, who holds the main responsibility to ensure the well-being of refugees? Is it the host country, the international community, the United Nations, or other groups?
Oh, that's a great question. So in terms of offering refuge and the ability to cross into a border and be in a safe space, it's the host country. So as we've been discussing with Somalis coming into Kenya, Kenya has been upholding its international responsibility to allow people to come into Kenya and be in a safe space. But there's, in addition to that, there is the UN Refugee Agency, which has an international mandate to provide support and services and protection to those people. Mm-hmm. So it's a joint effort. And even in Kenya, you have registration of refugee status by both the government and UNHCR, and UNHCR supporting what the government is doing. But ultimately, I think that it needs to be not just UNHCR and the host government, but an international effort, because it's too much for one country to take on its own.
Okay.
So I think that that each country is by being generous, we should reward the generosity by providing additional resources so that they aren't facing the full burden.
Okay. Now, Mary in Kenya says, what are the main challenges faced during the resettlement process for refugees? Are there certain challenges that are specific to Africa?
That's a great question. I don't think that it's necessarily an issue that's specific to Africa. I think that it's more of a global challenge. Mm-hmm. We talk about the numbers of displaced around the world. I think they're up to 60 million now. 20 million of those are refugees who theoretically would be eligible for resettlement. Globally, only 1% of that population will be resettled. So it's just, it's kind of mind-blowing how many people are displaced and how many people have fled borders to seek refuge. But ultimately, the tiniest fraction ends up being resettled to a third country. So it's something that needs to be improved across the globe.
Okay, because the next question almost, I think you almost answered the next question, which is by Alisa. And she was asking, to what extent do refugees have the opportunity to resettle? Very few of them do, right?
Right, and I think that's what's tragic is when we interview refugees in camps, even, you know, South Sudanese who are in Ethiopia, as wars continue and they lose hope of the ability to eventually go back home, resettlement becomes kind of the main hope. And it's a dream to be able to begin your life in a new place and have access to work and access to basic rights and education. And since that option is available to so few people, it's a huge problem in the how we treat refugees globally, and especially all the attention that's being received in Europe right now, and how I think there's a need to, you know, share the burden around the world rather than just countries who happen to receive people at their borders.
So how do, it's really, you mentioned Europe, and I guess my question about that is, there seem to be some type of struggle among different countries saying, no, this, you have to host more refugees. No, we can't have more. So how do we share the burden? What happens there?
Well, no, I mean, that's the issue, is how do you share the burden? But I think that it's completely unfair that certain countries are basically taking on the responsibility simply because of geography. So because Greece happens to be in the Mediterranean and has a large border of tiny islands that can't necessarily be monitored by the Coast Guard, there's a huge influx of people who are coming in and arriving there. And it's just by chance that they're in a geographic location where, you know, nearly, I think, 800,000 people have crossed through in 2015. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, but it's Greece didn't cause the war in Syria, and Greece won't be able to solve the war in Syria. But it's something that all of us globally are part of. And I think that the more countries, if more countries took on more people and resettled more people, mm-hmm. then it wouldn't be a significant burden to any country.
Okay. Now, going back to health care, if we go to any given refugee camp in sub-Saharan Africa, what are some of the basic health care that you will find or are available or should be available at least?
I mean, I think, again, once you're in a stable refugee camp situation, fortunately, there's generally international organizations, UNHCR, who are there present, providing services. So there's still challenges and problems in terms of specialized care, for example, that particular operations people need that they can't get in the camp. They'd have to go to a city mm-hmm. to receive. Where we see a lot of the problem is in internal displacement situations,
okay.
where people are forced to flee from their home. They don't have access to shelter. They don't have access to clean water. Women are literally giving birth out in a, you know, under the stars with no access to healthcare professionals.
Yes.
And that context is leading to so many deaths that should be avoidable if the conflicts weren't happening.
Hmm. So when we look at the different countries, can you give us a sense of some of the countries that are often receiving refugees due to some conflicts? I know that, for example, Tanzania has been receiving some refugees. Can you give us in what countries we see a lot of refugee influx?
Yeah, so as we've been discussing, there's certain areas that, you know, that have been hosting refugees for decades, as we discussed with Kenya, whereas
yes.
Tanzania similarly has been receiving refugees for many years, but there's been new influxes because of conflict in Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's Burundian refugees fleeing into Tanzania, also in Rwanda. Then with the Central African Republic, the conflict that's continuing there, there's refugees going into Cameroon and into the Democratic Republic of Congo. With South Sudan that we've been talking about earlier, refugees going into Ethiopia, into Uganda, into Kenya. It's pretty remarkable, and let alone, you know, moving towards West Africa, mm-hmm. and Nigerians who are fleeing because of violence related to Boko Haram, into Cameroon, into Niger in the north. And I think it paints an interesting picture because there are certain parts of Africa and certain countries where stability and economic growth has really moved the continent into more integrated into the global economy, and we're seeing a lot of significant benefit in entrepreneurship and a lot of innovative, exciting things happening out of the continent. But when that's happening on the one hand, and then there's a neighboring country that is in the midst of a devastating civil war, and people are fleeing across into their neighboring countries across the borders, it's going to have an impact on that, the ability of the continent as a whole to grow.
To grow. So would you say that if we look at the history and what is happening, would you say that conflict is the main reason why people are displaced and people seek refuge?
Yeah, certainly right now. And there's aspects related to climate. As desertification happens, we witnessed what happened in Somalia when it was the combination of conflict, lack of government, but then there was also several years in a row of drought that impacted planting. So when you combined the climatic effects with conflict, it was a recipe for absolute disaster. But at the same time, what's so tragic in a place like South Sudan mm-hmm. is that there isn't a drought, there isn't climatic issues. You mm-hmm. have people on the brink of famine purely because of fighting happening in the country. And I think that's what's so tragic when it's purely a man-made crisis, that it's completely unacceptable.
So let's talk about the work of Refugees International. What do you focus on, and what are your priorities as of right now?
So as an organization, we are looking to conduct research on the conditions and the situations for displaced populations, whether they're internally displaced or they're refugees. And then we want to take an independent look at, are there gaps in services? Is the UN operating the way it should? How is the host government behaving in terms of upholding refugee rights? Once we gather the first-hand information, we write policy reports and then use that information to advocate with government leaders in Washington, at the UN, in Europe, and then also with governments in Africa like Kenya and Ethiopia.
So how is it received? When you come out with these reports and you lobby, you advocate rather, what is the response?
I think generally it's appreciated that we come with firsthand information, and often, particularly with the U.S. government, there's, because of security, there can be a lot of restrictions on where government staff can travel. So if we're able to go into parts of Somalia that other officials aren't able to access, just coming back with a firsthand report on the reality of the severity of certain situations and what people on the ground are facing, I think is appreciated. And then also we don't have any, the people who we're targeting for advocacy, whether it's governments or the UN, we never receive any money from them in terms of our own funding. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an appreciation that the information is as independent as it can be and isn't impacted by other considerations.
And before we wrap up, if we were to say one or two main steps in terms of starting to resolve this issue, would you say end of conflict? Would you say money? Of course, end of conflict would be ideal. But where, if we want to resolve the first layer of the issue, what would be the problem?
Yeah, no question. Conflict is the source of it, and it's a political issue. But in terms of money, every conflict in Africa is every crisis is dramatically underfunded, and until those funding gaps are addressed, we can't even begin to have long-term solutions.
Mark Yanel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Mark Yanel, Senior Advocate with Refugees International, joining us today. I'm your host, Lino Mudu, in Washington, with producer Jackson Mugani. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.